Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are coming to you live from the Kintech studio. Kintech, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, and we continue to look ahead to Game 3 of the Stanley Cup Final, which goes tonight in Edmonton. Now joining us, he covers the Florida Panthers for the Hockey News. He is David Dwork. David, thank you for doing this. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. And Panthers up. I mean, first of all, have the Panthers recovered from just that that nightmare travel ordeal that they suffered through yesterday? Are they going to be able to play, David, tonight after, what was it, a two and a half hour delay yesterday getting to Edmonton?
You know, I think they're going to muster up the will. It is the Stanley Cup final after all. So I can't say for sure. I'm not in the room with them, but I've got a strong feeling that they'll be able to figure out a way to get their skates tied. You got on the ice tonight.
Yeah, just seeing the quotes from the Panthers players coming out this morning, talking to the media after their skate, it feels like it could not be less of a big deal, understandably, for the Florida Panthers. And, you know, you look at the two Stanley Cup final runs, obviously last year and now this year, and the thing that stands out as most different for the Panthers is their health. They were just so beaten up and in such rough condition by the time they played Vegas last year. This year they seem to be doing pretty well. Again, it's the Stanley Cup final, so everyone's dealing with something. But other than health, what's different? What stands out to you as kind of most different about this Panthers run compared to last year?
I think it's just kind of a combination of the experience and the maturity, and, you know, that's kind of like a 1A, 1B type thing. But what really stood out to me as the run has gone on, I mean, you had like the Bruin series where there was the Bennett hit on Marchand and the Panthers weren't getting drawn into any of the extracurriculars and keeping everything between the whistles. And that was, you know, kind of part of it. Then we get to the conference final. They beat the Rangers in six. They do it at home. When you think back to last year against Carolina, when they beat the Hurricanes in game four at home, the celebration and the vibe around the arena, I would imagine it was comparable to a Stanley Cup. It was unbelievably awesome to be a part of. And then you fast forward a year later to when they beat the Rangers, and it just felt very much like any other day. Obviously, you know, it was a big deal, but it didn't feel that big of a deal, especially compared to the experience from a year previous. So I think this is just a team that, like last year, they weren't expected to be there. It was an amazing run. Now there was more of an expectation. They had kind of this work ethic that they knew what was going to take to get there. And I think now there's only one thing that you're going to see them really celebrate and let their guard down, and that will be if they get two more wins over the next week.
Yeah, and you know, we always debate how much does playoff experience matter, how much does it contribute, and I know, you know, Chris Knobloch kind of downplayed it before the beginning of the series, but I think about a moment like this game tonight, and you're up 2-0, now you're going to the other team's building, and you know Edmonton is going to pull out all of the stops, right? Essentially, their season is on the line. Connor McDavid is going to be on the, you know, out there half the game. They're going to do absolutely everything they can. They're going to take their best shot. And it feels like this is the moment where that maturity you're talking about and that experience can pay off for the Panthers in a really loud building against a desperate team. This is where you can kind of rely on that experience you gained last year.
Yeah, absolutely. When you think back to last year's Cup Final, I think in three games in Vegas, the Panthers gave up almost 20 goals and just looked nothing like themselves. And obviously, as you said before, like the health factor came into it. But when you talk about the experience, like this is a Panthers team. They had that last year against Vegas, and that also this season tied Dallas for most road wins in the NHL. Very comfortable playing in those uncomfortable situations. And that was something that you heard kind of from day one from Paul Maurice with those tough training camps, is he wanted them to be comfortable when they weren't comfortable. So that way, when those moments came around, it would just be another thing for them. It would just be business as usual. So I think when you talk about playoff experience, it doesn't always come down to just being there, or maybe being a champion, but just being able to understand the ebbs and flows and the emotional ride that's going to come with that ride, and being able to manage it when you get there. And, you know, maybe in this situation like Florida, they didn't quite get there last year, but I really think the experience is paying huge dividends for them this time around.
David, with
yes,
regards to how the Panthers have done this, how they've got their 2-0 lead, and how they found their game sort of in that third period of game one. How do you rate the impact of their defensive play? And I know you're a goalie guy. How do you rate the impact of Bobrovsky? Which has been more important in your view?
Well, not to skate around your answer, but I think it's been hand in hand. I think the defensive systems and play of Florida overall has led to this resurgence from Sergei Bobrovsky over the last couple of years. Bob has not changed much in the way he goaltends. He's still very acrobatic, heavy push. You know, he's going to make a lot of those big flashy saves and maybe leave himself in a bit of a vulnerable situation for the second and third chance opportunities. The way that the Panthers defend now, they defend so well and they take away those second chance opportunities. They're sweeping rebounds out. They're blocking shots. They're blocking a lot of shots and not exposing Sergei Bobrovsky to those situations. There we go. I needed a glass of water. And now it's kind of rounded into Bob looking the way he has. Last year during the playoffs, Bob entered this zone that, you know, we hadn't seen him play in for quite a while. This year around, the shot totals are down, the high danger shots are down, and Bob's really taking care of everything that they're asking him to take care of. And so not to say that it's not great by Bob, but I think the way that Florida's been defending in front of him has been such a big part of why he's looked so good over the last couple of years.
That wasn't a very goalie guild answer, by the way. I feel like you might have your card-carrying membership revoked here, Dwork.
Gotta keep it real.
With regards to sort of the Barkov-Forsling of it all, right? Like, one thing we saw in games one and two, Forsling has spent 24 of McDavid's 32 head-to-head minutes matched up against him. I mean, that's as hard a hard match as you can get. That's like a rock match. Obviously, no last change for Maurice in game three. How much will that impact what we see tonight, do you think?
Yeah, I think he leans on that defensive pairing, and rightly so. You've got two shutdown defenders that can play very well offensively. But I think the Panthers have done a really good job, whether it's been with the Forsling-Ekblad combination or with keeping the Barkov line out there, with keeping McDavid and his guys kind of on the outside. I feel like we've seen a lot of Connor McDavid in terms of him skating a lot with the puck and trying to make a lot of plays and really trying to make things happen. But he hasn't been able to get into those dirty, grimy areas where, like, that I just kind of think back to that amazing power play goal he scored in the deciding game against Dallas. Like, getting into those areas of the ice, Ford has done a really good job of letting them spin their wheels a bit on the outside, not necessarily get into that area. Forsling may be the best skater on the team, and so that's an obviously play a big part. But, I mean, you've also got a situation where McDavid and those guys are being asked to play 25, 26 minutes a night. And I think back to game two in the third period where McDavid got behind the defense, looked like he was going to go on a breakaway, and then somehow Matthew Tkachuk was able to keep up with him. No disrespect to Matthew Tkachuk, but not necessarily the fleetest of foot kind of guy. And I think maybe that extra mileage that these guys are being asked to play right now might be playing a little bit of a part when it comes to those big moments late in games.
I think there's a lot of focus, David, on the special teams battle coming into this series, and it hasn't necessarily become a big part of the story. But, you know, I also look at what Florida did to Edmonton defensively 5-on-5 in game two. It feels like Edmonton's going to need to break through on the power play, or at least it would be a go long way to helping them finally generate some consistent offense in this series. How important is the special teams battle, in your view, going to be for the remainder of this series, however long that is? And does it just come down to, you know, something we talked about before the series, which is discipline from the Florida Panthers?
Well, I think the special teams battle has been big to this point. You've got, you know, the Panthers have gone 7-for-7 on the penalty kill against an Oilers power play that was pretty well vaunted coming in. I think they were like 36% or whatever it was. So, it has played a part to a certain extent. But if you're the Florida Panthers, and it's been the story all season, you want to play as much 5-on-5 as you can, because they are just going to wear you down 5-on-5. And they can come at you with four lines, and they can bring the same intensity with all those three defensive pairings. And that's really their bread and butter. Florida's penalty kill was a huge, huge thing they wanted to improve on from last year, and they did. And so they're not necessarily afraid of going there, as we've seen. You know, they've gone well against the Oilers. They did a good job against the Rangers as well, and really throughout the playoffs. And off it all comes back down for me to the Edmonton Oilers power play. You don't want to give them a chance, because if there's anything, as you said, that could really get them back into the series, it's to give that power play more and more opportunities, because, you know, it's only a matter of time, you would think, until those guys start to break through. So to this point, it's played a good part, but like I said, if you're Florida, you want to keep it 5-on-5. You go back to the end of last game where there was like some, you know, a couple little scrums or whatever at the end of the game, and Paul Maurice is yelling at the refs, "I don't want 4-on-4. Keep it 5-on-5. We don't have to give our guys a penalty." Like, he was like, "No, we don't need the penalty. Just keep it 5-on-5. So I think as much as they can keep it there, the better for them.
Yeah, Edmonton's going to be looking for any spark tonight, right? And if it's an early power play and they get a goal, that could be exactly what they need to kind of get back in this series. Who's your Conn Smythe pick for the Panthers so far?
I think right now the leader in the clubhouse is probably Bob after the game one that he had, and, you know, one goal against through two games against the Oilers. He was spectacular in the conference final. He was fine in the first two rounds. You know, no disparagement to Bob, but, you know, he kind of turned it up a little bit against the Rangers, and it seemed to have continued here against the Oilers. Obviously, he'd want that goal against Ekholm back, but if that's the only blemish so far, I think you're pretty happy. So not necessarily just flashing my goalie card. I think I'd be pretty honest with this vote. But to this point, I think it'd have to go to Bob.
I just feel like the Barkov defensive stats are like, I get it. It's Bobrovsky is the goalie, and it's easy to pay attention to the goalie. I understand that he's made some incredible saves. But like, if Barkov is able to keep doing the job against McDavid, and you add what he did in the earlier rounds against the litany of star players, like, he's gonna have a serious case for this, isn't he?
And rightly so. I don't disagree with you. I think that's, you know, I honestly couldn't tell you because I don't have a lot of experience in the Conn Smythe voting.
Sure.
Personally, I feel like the sexiness of it, and that's where it would maybe rise to the top. But I can't say for sure. And there is somebody as a goalie, I appreciate that defensive play. So I would have zero issue with it going to Barkey for those reasons. So that's fine with me, too, if it goes that way.
Yeah. I mean, and look, typically when a team wins the Stanley Cup, there's a lot of deserving players. And certainly if the Panthers are able to get these last two games and take home the cup, they will have a lot of deserving candidates, no doubt about it. David, really appreciate the time. Enjoy game three tonight.
Thanks for having me on, guys. Take care.
That is David Dwork covering the Florida Panthers for the Hockey News. And as you pointed out, Transfer, also a big goalie guy, giving some love. It does. I mean, Wish said Bobrovsky, too. I don't know that it's settled, right? There's still two games to win. Who knows, you know, up to five games remaining in this series. So certainly things can happen. The narratives can change. But I'm a little surprised to hear the kind of overwhelming it's going to Bobrovsky sentiment so far.
Well, the Oilers have one goal across two games, and Bobrovsky is seen to have stolen the first game, even though Florida, Edmonton Shooters just didn't lift the puck. I think we're really bad at separating the impact. Like, it, you know, when a team gets a lot of chances and doesn't score, we say they got goalied. But so often, like we saw in game six of the Western Conference Final, right, where everyone's like, you know, Stuart Skinner, he's so in control. And it's just like, Dallas just keeps missing on their glorious opportunities. In fact, there's large swaths of the game where Skinner doesn't know where the puck is. Like, what are we talking about? I feel like we need to begin to talk about getting shootered more. where a team just misses their spots, because I think that's what happened more than anything in the first game. And you know, I think there's been a lot of highlights, right? Like the barrel roll miss from Ryan Nugent-Hopkins is literally being played everywhere as if it's, you know, some highlight. Shoot or missed. It drives me nuts. So I don't know. I get it, but I also just think it would be a travesty if the Florida Panthers were able to shut down the Oilers like this and Sacha Barkov didn't win the MVP, given what we've seen from him all playoffs long. I mean, there's no question in my mind who the most important player for Florida is.
Well, and I also, Jen, as I said to David, like, you just think of, because one of the things that drives this is always the story aspect of it, right? And it's right. Always easy to hang a story on a goal. Yeah, and the t-shirts. But if you're building a story for Barkov, again, as I said, you go through the list of players that he's shut down in these playoffs, right? Or that he's had a major role in shutting down. I realize it's not him. You know, he's got Sam Reinhart. He's got Ekblad and Forsling out there. But he's kind of the tip of the spear when it comes to it. And it just goes from, you know, Kucherov, Pasternak, Panarin, and then climbing the summit to McDavid and Draisaitl. Like, that's a really, really compelling narrative to kind of hang your hat on if you're Sacha Barkov.
For sure. I mean, without question. And so It'll be interesting to see how this goes, because as much as Bobrovsky goes into game three in the lead, all it's going to take is 1-4-goal Oilers game to flip that narrative pretty fast, right? And we know what this Oilers team can do, right? Like, we know how quickly they can turn a series if they get scoring on the power play, or if they get, you know, moving off the rush, right? And that's sort of going to be one of the main things to watch for tonight. I am very curious to see if the Oilers have one more trick up their sleeve, or if the Panthers' pressure game is just going to keep overwhelming them. Because for me, that's been, you know, that was even present in game one. I think people are really overplaying the Oilers' dominance in game one. Like, don't get me wrong, the Oilers should have probably been able to at least tie it 2-2. But it was like a 58-42 sort of performance, not a 80%, 20%. I feel like we're really bad these days at sort of recognizing those when we see them. It didn't look like Dallas's loss to Edmonton in game six, where it was truly like an 80-20 smash and grab. I just didn't think game one looked like that. I thought the Panthers were fortunate to keep the Oilers off the board. I didn't think they were fortunate to win the game. And one of the main reasons was that when it counted in the third period, in the first period, as the Panthers built that two-goal lead, you know, Edmonton couldn't get moving. Edmonton's breakout, especially when Bouchard and Ekholm aren't on the ice, was far too inconsistent. They were getting bogged down in their own end, and it prevented them, you know, for like too frequently from getting set up for heavy shifts in the offensive zone, especially in those moments when McDavid wasn't on the ice.
I think the other thing with game one is that the Panthers were probably at their best in the third period, right? In terms of controlling the game, which was when you would expect Florida to really, really turn, or sorry, Edmonton to really turn it on, trailing in the third period. And yet that was probably the most successful stretch of play for the Panthers, which I think stands out in terms of what you're talking about, right? Like, people might have been reacting to the first half of the game. You're like, oh, this is overwhelming from Edmonton's perspective. But then Florida really clawed back and asserted more control as that game went along. I kind of think Edmonton gets this one tonight, just because this is as close as you can get to season on the line without it actually being an elimination game, right? You fall down 3-0. You're cooked at that point. I know it's happened before in the NHL, but you're probably cooked at that point. So I would expect them to just absolutely empty the chamber. Huge minutes for McDavid. But I don't think I don't think they're going to dominate. Like, I don't think they're going to run the Panthers out of the building. I think the Panthers are too good for that. So Edmonton's going to fire their best shot. I think it will probably be enough to win, but it's still going to be a pretty narrow margin at least. Look, it's one game. Crazy things can happen. But that's kind of my read on the game going into tonight.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was saying before the series, I thought the Panthers had the edge in enough areas that mattered, that even though I thought the games would be close, which I think we've seen, I thought the Panthers were going to be able to win this relatively quickly. I'm curious to see what Edmonton can muster here, right? Like, I'm really curious, because I've obviously seen nothing in this series to disabuse myself of that notion.
All right, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Lots of thoughts coming in. You okay there, Drancer?
Yep, good.
Okay. Anyways, just a lot of like,
what did you hear?
A lot of mic noises, like things banging up against the mic. That's all right. There we go. Happened
nothing's
again.
Banging up against the mic. Excuse me.
I have no idea what's going on right now on your end of things. But anyways, we will power through. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. So to get back to our earlier conversation that we started the show with, you know, we're hearing the reports that the Canucks might be kind of moving on from Elias Lindholm. It might just be too much. Not a lot of progress on Nikita Zadorov. Could that be another guy who's going to depart? Dakota Joshua sounds very much like the door is still open, obviously, that, you know, they're both sides want to reach an agreement, but he also knows he's going to be heavily in demand when the market opens. And you start to kind of reach this point where three guys who I think Canucks fans all are, for the most part, pretty fond of, right, in terms of what they did for this team in the playoffs, in Lindholm, Zadorov, and Joshua, there definitely exists a world. I'm not saying it's a guarantee by any stretch, but there exists a world where all three of them are playing elsewhere come next season. And we've focused a lot on the Canucks' need to go find that star winger, right, that star guy in the top six who can really help them generate offense. I also kind of think, like, let's say for the sake of argument, that all of Lindholm, Zadorov, and Joshua are end up playing elsewhere and don't re-sign with the team, at that point, that's a lot of salary cap space that you haven't committed to those players. I think we're right to focus on the need for a star winger. I kind of think you start to get in the neighborhood of, okay, do you need two star wingers or at least one true star and then another very, very good top six player? Like, is that the best use of all of that salary cap space that you're not committing to kind of the glue guys, the playoff guys who were so good for you in the Stanley Cup playoffs? And, you know, we talk about Jake Guentzel. He's going to be super, super in demand. Elsewhere on the free agent market, there's not a lot of interesting names. And then I think you get into the trade market, which could potentially have some interesting names, right? And we talk about, you know, the idea of whether it's a Nick Ehlers out of Winnipeg. We've talked about Trevor Zegras. Frank Saravelli has his trade targets board up with some interesting names. And also, and this text came in, 650. I'm going to do it. Do you guys think there's a chance the Canucks try to get Patrick Laine? What say you, Drance?
If I start talking, man, we're going to go over time. So let's save the Laine takes for the second segment. But I will happily go into depth about why Laine is an awful fit for the Canucks.
An awful fit. All right. I'm excited
awful
to
fit. Like shouldn't even be a significant consideration unless they're basically giving him away.
Which they might get to that point. I think that's what
if they do.
Yeah.
I'm interested.
We got to know,
but it's going to take that.
We're open in the next segment. So we can go a little bit over here. Sorry, Dom, cover your ears. Pretend I didn't say that. So let's just do it now. Okay, so Patrick Laine, your athletic colleague Pierre Lebrun reporting that he would like a fresh start, wants to move on from Columbus. I think 2 years, $8.7 million, I believe, on his deal left for this one. I think we all kind of know the story of Patrick Laine, right? High draft pedigree, comes in, scores goals at an incredible rate early in his career in Winnipeg. Injuries, maybe not the most all-round player in Columbus. Now he wants a fresh start. And
maybe.
And
maybe
I think
not the... What do you... Jesus.
I'm just setting it out. I'm setting it out objectively. And I think there are a lot of reasons to be very concerned about the player. But it comes down to the acquisition cost, right? And it comes down to at what point does the acquisition cost get so low that you're willing to bet on the talent? Because he has been productive in terms of scoring goals in Columbus. It's just been health has been a big factor. And then you can say, like, well, how much of that is power play? Is he going to be a key power play here guy? I think, again, there's plenty of red flags. There's plenty of reasons to be concerned. But I also think about, you know, similar to the Trevor Zegras conversation, at a certain point, do you need to take a swing? Or does it become a smart bet to take a swing on a guy who has a ton of talent, even if there are a bunch of red flags surrounding him?
Yeah, but Zegras has a dual threat ability. Right, Zegras has consistently driven play, even if his defensive impact hasn't been there. Laine doesn't drive play. Laine scores from one spot on the ice, and it's the spot in the ice 5-on-4 that I want JT Miller to spend most of the time occupying. So he's got one elite skill, right? His shot from the left flank on the power play. And the Canucks have a guy who I personally have no desire to see supplanted from being primarily there, even though I'm sure Rick Tocchet would like to see some more movement. I think we all would like to see more movement. So we'd like to see some more Pettersson there too. But, you know, it's Laine, despite his listed dimensions, isn't lining up at the net front. Right?
No.
Like, that's not where he's going to score his goals. That's not where he's going to do his damage. I think he's really struggled to adapt. I think he's got one elite skill. He doesn't drive play. His two-way impact is hit and miss, to put it kindly. I just don't see a lot of dog there. I don't see the adaptability that I think you can project with Zegras, who's also significantly younger, right? Like that's another part.
Significantly cheaper as well.
Yeah. Right. 5.75 versus 8.7. I mean, that's a gulf. That's a third line center worth of cap difference. You know me. I'm all about gambling on, you know, talented guys who've yet to really hit. But when I'm sort of talking about those guys, I'm sort of more interested in your 22, 23-year-olds, right? Like the guys who are young enough that you can understand why it's taken them some time to grow up, as opposed to your 26-year-olds who haven't kind of fleshed out their game. Like, for me, at some point, you hit an age where it's like you are what you are. And 26, I mean, you're outside your statistical prime. Like, why are you gambling on a guy figuring it outside their statistical prime when you can do it with a younger player? The other types of guys in and around his age that I'd, you know, be more interested in seeing the Canucks try to acquire and gamble on are guys with, like, injury context behind them. And I think about, like, Josh Norris from the Ottawa Senators there, who at 25 is still, like, a one-thirds buyout, and you're interested to see if the Senators maybe consider it because it's only, like, $1.5 million a year to get off of that cap hit, and the cap ramifications are meager. You know, that's a guy that might really be available for pennies on the dollar where, you know, at the end of the day, he scored at a 55-point-per-82-game pace and has good two-way results throughout his career. He's, like, a pretty well-rounded player. It's just that he hasn't been able to stay healthy. Like, you know, you see the medicals there. That's the type of gamble I'd prefer to place as opposed to, like, a deeply one-dimensional player who's shown no ability or willingness to adapt his game and whose one sick trick, which is a sick trick, by the way, overlaps with, you know, the space on the ice that one of your best forwards operates from. I mean, I just see no fit there. Zero.
That's the key for me. Is
a bad idea.
Is the power play thing, right? Because if you're a team acquiring Patrick Laine, it has to be with the idea we're going to put him in the position to succeed on the power play. He's going to be a huge part of why our power play is successful because, as you said, he has a legitimately elite skill there. He can put the puck in the net from that spot. That's not going to happen with the Canucks. You can institute as much movement as you want, right? But you're still going to have JT Miller in that spot an awful lot at 5-on-4. It would kind of remind me of going and acquiring a defenseman whose value is tied up in the power play, right? And it's like, well, but you have Quinn Hughes, right? You're not supplanting Quinn Hughes on the power play. So, like, if this defenseman needs to be on power play one, what role are they going to play on this team? Again, I'm at least here for the discussion, right? Depending on how low the price comes, and is this like a plan B or C thing, right? If you're not able to go find other options in your top six, I think we all agree they need that infusion of talent, but it can't come completely at the cost of fit. And if there was more of a fit on the power play, at least you say, okay, hey, at least we'll have that element of it, and we'll try to work with him on his 5-on-5 game. We'll hope that we can find a fit. We'll hope we can develop him in Tocchet's system. I think you could make a defensible case for it. The fact that his greatest strength is not going to be immediately helpful for you, it's tough to see it really making sense for the Canucks, even though he probably is going to be available very, very cheaply this season this summer from the Columbus Blue Jackets. Okay.
Give me one more line. Ready?
Sure.
No one's ever made a penny betting on Patrick Laine, and that's not going to change this summer.
All right. Wow. There you go. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Other thoughts coming in about how the Canucks can address top six needs going into the summer. We'll run through maybe some other trade targets as well and take some of your texts here. Final segment of the show coming up. Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on the People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets. Weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance, live from the Kintech studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at dunbarlumber.com. Ryan in Penticton texts in to the Dunbar Lumber text line. With the need for additional top six help, is it time that the Canucks try to get Garland onto one of Miller or Pettersson's line? Obviously, there's still a need for a top of the lineup star, but I don't think more ice time for Garland is a bad thing. That's from Ryan in Penticton. And as he said, that's not the solution, right? That's not the only solution. Overall, you need more talent. You need more offensive talent in your forward group. But as I was making the point, right, like if you have all this cap flexibility, your biggest need is a star winger. Your second biggest need might be an additional really good player in your top six, right? Like this might need to be a not just a Jake Guentzel situation, but a Jake Guentzel or alternative plus situation. And I do wonder if Connor Garland can be part of that plus, right? Like all of a sudden, let's say you do land a high profile UFA or trade target to play in your top six and you move Garland up. We can get to what it does to the bottom half of your lineup in a second. But I do think if he's able to find that chemistry with, I think it would be Elias Pettersson, because we're probably going to see Brock Besser with JT Miller, given how successful they've been together. All of a sudden, your top six takes on a very different complexion than it had certainly towards the end of last season.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't actually really think that you need an additional top six forward if you get a star. Like, if you get a Guentzel type, you know, so that Besser's your second best winger and Garland's your third best winger,
mm-hmm.
I think you have enough. I think you have enough to, with the way this team defends, compete. Like, compete, and I don't mean compete, like, to win the division. I mean, like, compete for the Stanley Cup. Like, compete at the absolute highest level. I think if you're able to land a star, then I do think your needs shift back to reinforcing what was good about this team, right? Like, this team's strengths, by the time they hit the playoffs this year, you know, size on defense, ability to play lockdown hockey, center depth, you know, those are all being eaten away at, right? Myers, Cole, Hronek, and Zadorov out of contract, Lindholm and Bluger out of contract. You know, by the time Guentzel or a player like him costs you 10 million against the cap, right? I mean, Ehlers would be 6, Zegras 5.75, Lyonnais 8.7, Marner 11 plus. Mm-hmm. So just to like quickly take a run through the candidates, yeah. I mean,
Buchnevich,
it varies.
Buchnevich potentially as a trade target candidate, 5.8.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, that's a guy I wanted
to bring
up. That
might be my favorite fit.
Yeah, I mean, he had been rumored at the trade deadline, not Canucks specifically, but just a guy who was out there, but the asking price was really, really big. And I'd kind of forgotten about him going into the summer, but then he was on Frank Saravelli's trade targets board. And, you know, he's due for an extension, right? He's 29. All of a sudden, if he's on the trade market, I mean, that becomes a really fascinating option.
Well, especially because he can play every forward position, right? So he gives you additional versatility. And, you know, he has a size in a north-south game that you can see really being a good complement with how the Canucks want to forecheck and play, right? So Buchnevich might be my favorite of the targets listed. Although I want to make the argument for Mitch Marner here.
Okay.
Because I feel like Mitch Marner, the disappearing acts in the playoffs have become real, right? We're talking about a large enough sample now that I don't think it's fair to be like, oh, well, whatever, right? Like, you can't, whatever. Guy's a $9 million player, paid $11 million, right? There are real drawbacks there. But I also think when you consider the fit, it's pretty great, right? Like, he's a puck-dominant winger who crushes on entries and would be a perfect fit if the Canucks wanted to have like a more movement-based power play, right? Because you're comfortable with him starting in the slot. You're comfortable with him at either half-wall spot. He wins a lot of battles, right? Like he's really good on retrievals, and he's really good. Like him and Hughes conspiring to enter the zone together on the power play will really help you avoid some of that like bogged down stuff that we saw, you know, certainly in the first period against the Edmonton Oilers in game seven, right? Like there's an element to which, you know, given his handedness, given his skill set, you know, him with Besser, Miller, Pettersson, Hughes, power play one. I mean, that's ridiculous, right? And such a complimentary pass first guy. He can almost fill like the Ryan Nugent Hopkins role for you 5-on-4, right? Especially if you want to have more movement. But then, most importantly, perhaps, we're talking about a guy who is an elite like hands down elite penalty killer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, that makes him super complimentary with what the Canucks already have, right? Where Pettersson can kill, like Pettersson and Miller can kill penalties, but neither of them's great at it, right? Like the Canucks penalty kill's best moments this season happened when both of their roles were reduced 4-on-5, right? And it's not a coincidence. Like they can do it, but I don't think either guy is a guy you want first over the boards. Marner is always going to be a first over the boards penalty kill guy. He is one of like a handful of special penalty kill contributors in the NHL. And then, you know, the idea of having Besser, Miller, Marner, Pettersson as your duos, right? And then, you know, you can have Garland as like a third line engine, but he can bump up. I mean, realistically, I think you still want to find Garland another duo. And then you kind of mix and match through those. You know, Pew Suter is a good option to be one of those sort of left-handed bodies. Hoglander is a good option to be one of those left-handed bodies. You know, Mikheyev maybe, but ideally you seek like a different, bigger-bodied guy with maybe a little more finish, and boom, like you're set. You've got a really nice forward group there. So I don't know why. I just can't escape it in my mind's eye when I go through these list of players. It feels to me like, honestly, we're sleeping on, and in part I think because he's been denigrated so widely by the hockey world that loves to dump on the Maple Leafs, and now he's getting dumped on in the center of the hockey universe as well. And of course, he's got a no move clause and he's got a lot of control. And, you know, after his experience in Toronto, would he even want to come to another madcap hockey market? I mean,
yep.
I'm not saying it's a straightforward one, but, you know, given the fact that he's legitimately overpaid and how few teams could actually fit that contract in the first place, and his control over the situation, I mean, I don't think you're talking about like a mega return for Toronto. Like, I think you're talking about like a distressed forward asset on a big ticket and probably one solid future. Like, I even think the acquisition cost has a chance to be far more reasonable than we think. I can't escape that one as like my perfect fit for the Canucks.
So on Marner, I think you make a good point. I was going to bring this up, right? He has the full no move clause, and it feels like he wants to stay in Toronto, but if he bends on that, is it going to be for another place where there's going to be so much heat and so much attention on him, right? Or is it going to be for Utah, or is it going to be even for Vegas, where it's like competitive, but it's not the same fishbowl atmosphere as it would be in Canada?
Don't let Vegas get another one.
No,
come on.
No. But basically what you're saying is Jim Rutherford is going to go out and target, a distressed and unfairly criticized high pedigree Toronto winger to bring in to put his team over the top. It worked for him last time.
It's never worked before, but it might work for us.
No, it did work for him. Phil Kessel.
I know. I was being sarcastic.
It worked wonderfully for him the last time he did it.
Yes, it did.
The other thing is, don't you think, and I know our friend Jay Fresh on Twitter has been pushing. Go ahead. What?
Sorry. All we need is someone to leak that Marner is a fan of a specific fast food item. And then everyone needs to refer to him as Mercurial. And the synergy or the symmetry will be complete.
Oh, man, that's fantastic. I know Jay Fresh, our pal on Twitter, has been saying it's going to be Marner to Vegas for Alex Pietrangelo, right? Because the Leafs are going to be like, the veteran leadership of Pietrangelo, we're making him the captain. This is going to put us over the top. And then, meanwhile, Vegas gets way younger and, you know, adds another star to their roster of stars. I do feel like that's the ideal, you know, Pietrangelo fits that mold really well, but like that's what the Canucks need to have is like the older guy who has that winner vibe about him that the Leafs would go crazy for, right? Like that's the real sweet spot if you're going to be acquiring Mitch Marner. I don't know if they have that.
No, they don't.
Unfortunately.
They don't. They yeah.
But I do think you're right about,
anyway,
I do think you're right about the acquisition cost though, right? Like between the questions about his game, 1 year left, the no move clause. Yes, there's tons of caps. There's more cap space in the system, but still that's a hard one to fit in. If the Leafs don't want to retain, you know, like that, are you going to have to give up more to get Buznevich than you would to get Marner? Like probably.
Oh yeah.
Right. So from that perspective, all of a sudden it actually becomes, and you're probably end up paying him like maybe $1 million more than you would be paying Jake Guentzel, maybe slightly more than that. Right. But not a huge premium. And yeah, there's going to be questions about the playoff performance and all of that. But, you know, like we talked about Line A earlier, Zegras, Marner's obviously a much higher caliber of player, but at a certain point, you do have to be willing to gamble a little bit on a player, right? And I've made this point with, hey, you have Rick Tocchet. Gamble on him being able to get more out of Mitch Marner, right? Gamble on him being able to put Mitch Marner in a position to succeed. I'm not saying it's the only option, but I think you're right that if a player with that much talent who checks that many boxes is on the table, is potentially available, you have to at least think about it, plan it out, kind of game it out to see what it would look like, because those players don't come along all that often.
No, and I think there's unique fit stuff there, especially with, you know, the idea of him and Pettersson attacking off the rush together, and you know how that could work if Pettersson's back on his game when next season begins, which I expect he will be. I mean, plus the penalty killing stuff. I mean, yeah, I just can't escape it. I keep thinking about it and I keep circling back. But to come back to my sort of larger point here before I got sidetracked with my Marner argument.
Yeah.
I think if you get one elite winger, I think your focus has to shift back to the rest of the team, to your center depth, right? Especially to figuring out that third line center problem, which I think is going to be a significant one in the event that the Canucks, well, the probable event that the Canucks move on from Elias Lindholm. I think you have to be mindful of getting some size into your lineup. If Dakota Joshua and some of those defenders, jump ship. I think we assume that Myers is coming back. That'll help in terms of fleshing out the defensive depth. But I'd say even if you add an elite winger, even if you can replace the third line center, even if you can find some size on the wings, which would sort of be what I'd take precedence on over finding the right, like, you know, another top six for it. I'd just be like, find a big guy, find another big body, because I really think you notice it. You really noticed it when Joshua wasn't in this lineup, especially with how the Canucks want to play. You know, I think you need a big body. And I'd even suggest to you, you know, we've talked a lot about Hronek's impact on Hughes. What about Joshua's impact on Garland?
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
That's a duo that you're going to miss if you don't have it. I do think that they were more than the sum of their parts. And I think part of it was the size complement. Like, I think it matters to have, you know, a bigger body making space for Garland and a bigger body to serve as like a backboard in front of the net for some of Garland's passing, especially from down low. So, you know, I think you have to be cognizant of finding like, you know, a bigger bodied forward, ideally to play with Garland. Maybe it's a center. That would be ideal. But, you know, something like that, because I think you want to be protective of that synergy, that value that those two provided you. And then I come back to this. I still think you need a top pair caliber defenseman. And that's even if you extend Filip Hronek.
If you keep Hronek, right? Like, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, I think we've gone through a lot of stuff, but $27.5 million in cap space, like you have the space to do it.
You can do a lot of different things.
You can do a lot of different things. Like, there's a ton of ways to go about this. And maybe you don't find like the bona fide top pair, you know, drive your own pair by yourself guy, but even a fringe one, right? Like, man, it would make a huge difference. Like, I still think this team's shy a difference maker on the back end. Not a you know, good defenseman, not a Soucy type or a Zadorov type, but like something a little more elevated than that. A player that can attack with the puck. Almost like a Noah Hanifin caliber defenseman. And man, those are not easy players to find. You know, for me anyway, I think if you are able to land the star forward as opposed to having to like cobble it together with, you know, a couple of like DeBrusque, Chandler Stephenson type bets, then I really do think you can shift your focus pretty neatly back to, you know, glue guys, upgrading your defense core, not just replacing the guys you're losing, but upgrading your defense core and making sure that you maintain the strength down the middle that I think was so essential to what Vancouver was able to accomplish this past season.
Well, and on the point about the center depth, you know, you made the point about the synergy between Joshua and Garland, and it extended beyond them, right? Because it also kind of gave them a pre-manufactured third line, no matter who you put in at center, right? Like, that you could feel pretty good about, like, hey, we've got Joshua and Garland, so I know it didn't work quite as well with Lindholm there as it had with Blueger and Suter, but I think it does, if you have that duo together, it alleviates at least some of your concerns, at least to start the season, about what you're doing at third line center. The focus on, like, again, let's say they go get a star winger, right? then the you can focus a little bit more on glue guys. I do agree with you, your point about the defenseman finding that extra guy on the blue line and how important that would be. But Andrew and Langley texted in earlier, in your mind, is management more likely to go after big ticket free agents and then hope some AHL prospects like Podkolzin and Baines, et cetera, fill in the gaps? Or do you foresee management finding pieces to insulate the younger fringe NHLers? He says, I'm afraid to overpay for bottom six help, but I also don't necessarily think the prospects have shown enough to pencil them in as quality NHL depth. That's from Andrew and Langley. And I think it's going to be really key, at least as it relates to the glue guys, for management to kind of repeat what they were able to do last summer and find those important pieces at, you know, 1 year term or extremely low cost. So to kind of thread that needle where you're not just, you know, relying on a whole bunch of guys to come up from Abbotsford and play important roles for you, but you're also not getting caught in the, you know, we're paying Jay Beagle and Antoine Roussel over 4 years to come in and play bottom six roles for us. You find that middle ground where you're able to find the more affordable options. And, you know, Rick Dhaliwal reported Brandon Duhaim as a potential target for them. I know we've brought up Brendan Dillon, right, as a good defenseman with size. Now, are they going to be super cheap? I don't know, but I do think that's going to be absolutely key. Do what you're talking about. Keep, you know, find those traits that gave you that identity and made you tough to play against and made you successful. But you also have to be so careful about committing term, committing too much salary to guys at the bottom half of your roster.
Yeah, I think Duhaime's the wrong big-bodied, unrestricted free agent Avalanche winger to target based on how the Canucks like to play. I think Yakov Trenin, for me, just fits the, like, north-south, forecheck, neutral zone wedge type game that Rick Tocchet wants to play a little bit better. Even though Duhaime's better with the puck and is meaner, more consistently, maybe plays with a little bit more of that Joshua-type identity, I think Trenin's speed is probably a neater fit with what Vancouver needs. The other guy that I'm always watching is Christian Fisher out of Detroit, just because he's played for Tocchet before. My understanding is he's kind of in that, like, Garland mold of teacher's pet Tocchet favorite, like longstanding Tocchet guy. So he's another big physical forward who, you know, I'd sort of have my eye on. And yeah, I think you're right. You bring in some guys into the mix and then you put Podkolzin and Archdeep Baines and even Jonathan Lekaramäki, not in a position where they're blocked, but in a position where if they're used, they earned it.
Yep. Where you're not counting on them right at the start of training camp, but there's a path to them making the team.
Exactly right. Like, you can, if you beat out this guy, you're going to get the job. But we're not coming into the season expecting Archdeep Baines to play top 9 minutes. We're open to him winning that job, though. Right. Mm-hmm. That's the sweet spot. And I think that's where, you know, this management group's been really solid and I think is going to have an opportunity, too, to sell, especially like come July 2nd after guys like Joshua and on get paid.
Yeah.
You know, one thing they're going to be able to sell to every agent is like, come to our program because look what happens if it works. Like, look at what we can do for you and what you can do for us for the league minimum.
Yeah. You be the next Dakota Joshua who just made, you know, $12 million or $14 million or whatever it is in free agency, right? We will help
pitch,
you do
right?
that. Yeah, it is a really good. That's kind of one of the silver linings if Dakota Joshua does sign elsewhere for them, right? Like, they get to say, hey, look how much money we made this guy. Come be part of that next time. We'll help you do the same thing. All right, we'll wrap up there.
Player development. Thank you. Double-edged sword.
There you go. Thank you for listening. Thank you for texting in. Drance is off tomorrow. Bick and I are going to be live from the Nat. Hopefully the weather holds. We'll get you teed up for the Seas game. So starting at 11, Drancer will be back on Monday. Enjoy game 3. Have a great night. Keep it right here on Sportsnet 650.